Hi, I'm everyone's favorite two-minute enchantment card draw engine, Kira.
Beep, boop.
Maya.
And Kira, we're in my favorite part of the standard season.
Post-Pro Tour.
Post-Pro Tour metagame. It's so exciting. The format's just been shaken up. We've seen some really crazy things. I was proven staggeringly wrong, which is my favorite state of affairs. And we're going to be talking about it.
That indeed we are. I was absolutely delighted, excited, terrified at all points during this Pro Tour. We had everything this Pro Tour from a dominating metagame from some predictable archetypes that we expected kind of going into a deck coming out of left field and making it to top eight in his first Pro Tour ever to cheating allegations. And it was insane. Like this Pro Tour had everything.
It was an absolutely wild ride, and the quality of play across every single match was so high. There's nothing quite like watching pro players do their thing. It is truly, truly amazing.
If you are playing any of these decks right now, I implore you to watch gameplay footage from the Pro Tour of a pro player playing the deck that you're playing and look at the patterns, look at the decisions that they make or the decisions they don't make. You will learn so much. There were plays that blew my mind. I was so impressed. I was taken aback. I was learning as much as anyone else, I think. It was an impressive Pro Tour. This, of course, was Pro Tour Aether Drift at MagicCon Chicago. We got to see a handful of new cards make their way into the standard meta, some that we didn't see coming, and others are mainstays that we've expected to see and we were happy to see. Let's get into it.
What did we, in terms of a metagame perspective, what did we actually see at this Pro Tour?
We saw an absolutely staggering representation in the top three decks. That was Gruul Mice with a 66-player representation, Esper Pixie with a 58-player representation, and Domain Overlords with a 53-player representation.
So for context, there are 348 players at Chicago. That's fully 50% of the field.
It is insane. Each of those decks is upwards of 15% representation. And to give you an idea of how overrepresented these decks are, the next highest represented deck was Jeskai Oculus with 21 players. That is a full 32 players between Jeskai Oculus and Domain Overlords with only a 6% field representation.
Fully a 60% drop.
Unbelievable. The top three decks dominated the field. And I think we saw this coming. I think we prepared and expected to see those three. If there were any people that we expected to come sit at the Pro Tour table, I'm shaking hands with Gruul Mice and Gruul Aggro. I'm shaking hands reluctantly with Esper Pixie. And I am not surprised that Domain Overlords is already at the table sitting down.
Certainly. Was well prepared. Had sat down a month ago. Was very established in their position.
Very comfortable.
Yeah. Having a lovely time. Just feasting on the yummy new toys it got with Aether Drift. Oh, what a amazingly exciting Pro Tour. And it's interesting that the domination of the existing decks actually did carry through all the way through to the top eight, because that's not something we often see with the Pro Tour. Often we'll see decks come out of left field that fundamentally change the shape of what the metagame looks like. But while we definitely saw a shift in the overall metagame representation with Azure Overlords wildly overrepresenting itself, it was actually those stalwart decks that overperformed instead of necessarily something new.
However, that being said, of those top three, Esper Pixie did not make it to top eight.
No, no. And I think this was because Esper Pixie was the deck to beat.
Yes. If you needed to beat any deck at this event, it was Esper Pixie. And I think that also lends itself towards the overrepresentation of Gruul, of a very aggro-slanted deck.
It is telling as well that Azure Overlords did so well. I think it was, I would argue it was the best performing deck at the Pro Tour, not only because it had a wild representation in the top eight, but also because with a very high sample size of 52 players, it still had an almost 56% win rate, which is almost unimaginable. And part of the reason for this success is what we actually talked about on our Pro Tour episode, talking about controls placement in a Pro Tour metagame, and how it actually is better because of the natural shift at the Pro Tour towards slightly more mid-rangey strategies. There was some commentary made about this by Corey Baumeister, talking about how the Gruul aggro decks in particular had actually built to go over the top of each other and shifted in a more mid-range direction. And do you know what loves a more mid-range direction on an aggro deck?
Overlords.
Control. Any slow controlling strategy. And it helps that, of course, Azur is completely ridiculous.
The way that I see it, it looked kind of like this. You have a small fish, that's Esper Pixie. There's a bigger fish coming to bite it, and that's Gruul aggro. And then the bigger fish behind those two fish is Overlords.
There's always a bigger fish.
There's always a bigger fish. Now, we're still waiting to see if there is a bigger fish behind Overlords, because at the moment, there isn't one. Azur Overlords dominated the Pro Tour. It dominated the top eight. We had three different Azur Overlords in the top eight. Three of them were top four decks.
It's so hard to imagine a deck that goes bigger than Azur Overlords, but we did kind of see it. One of the decks that actually was well positioned against Azur Overlords, which came in, was a relatively, well, not a new figure so much as we haven't seen it since the rotation of Kamigawa Neon Dynasty, was blue-white control. While it definitely took a hit with the loss of the Wandering Emperor, the prevalence of a extremely big mid-range deck, which is more what I would describe Azur Overlords as opposed to a strict control deck, allowed for a like true blue-white counterspell removal spell draw card control deck to exist. And I believe there were eight players and it performed relatively well.
It is in. It is listed in the top 16 of our deck archetypes that had a higher like win rate. It is in the third position with a 66% win rate,
which is pretty good.
And this of course like slightly skewed by the fact that there are a few number of players.
Sure, heavily skewed even.
Well, that's like we would see you'd see from this chart as we're going to talk about in a second that Orzhov Pixie has the highest win rate, but that again, outlier bias, there was one player on Orzhov Pixie.
Can I just say, that deck looks incredibly sweet. I am building that on Arena tomorrow, and it is what I will be playing for the foreseeable future. That deck is so cool!
Additionally, Mono Red had a really good showing for this event. Only 11 players, but still the fifth most represented deck archetype by player population.
With a very good win rate sitting at 56.5% and with a top eight presence.
Applause, applause, claps for Mono Red Aggro. I have been much the believer in the sign of a healthy metagame is the prevalence of Mono Red Aggro. A metagame where Mono Red Aggro can not only exist but thrive is a healthy standard metagame. That is due to a couple of mitigating factors. The cost of Mono Red Aggro decks is typically pretty low to the ground. There are not very many expensive mono red cards pretty much in any standard format I've seen in the last few years, but also due to the ease of play. It is a very easy deck to pick up because your game plan is typically turn sideways, beat face. And that is a great strategy for newer players. It's a great way to learn to play aggressive. And it's just, it's very clean. It's very focused. You don't have to worry about mitigating strategies. You don't have to plan really for late game. Your mountains enter tapped and you beat face.
Mono Red is something I would describe as a low skill floor, high skill ceiling deck. I think as a new player walking in, you can play the deck at 80% of its capacity relatively easily. It does not take a lot of work to play the deck relatively well and relatively cleanly. But I also think that the difference between those 80% players and the players who are playing Mono Red at its best is huge. There is such a wide skill gap between those two things, and the deck is really rewarding, which is part of what makes it such a positive thing that there is a strong presence of it in this standard metagame, because it gives newer players the chance to play relatively cheaply, a chance to play a proactive deck that requires them to think about the things in the format that is relatively easy to play, but also gives them so much room to grow, which is such an important factor in creating a healthy and positive metagame. And there's also room to grow in terms of deck archetype, because the Mono Red deck, while it's quite similar, a lot of the expensive cards are the same expensive cards as in the Gruul decks, namely Screaming Nemesis and the Mice package. It's so wonderful to see it do so well, and to see it do so well, might I say, without Leyline.
while initially, even I initially, terrified of Leyline when it first came out, coupled with the Valiant Mice and all of that, terrifying start for Leyline. Powerful enough to the point that it's banned in Best of One Arena. It is a very good card, but it's not good enough, which seems crazy given how powerful and how strong and how fast both Mono Red and Gruul Aggro are. It seems crazy that Leyline typically takes up an extra spot that you need for either another burn spell or another pump spell.
I think it is a symptom of the Pro Tour metagame as well. The Leyline versions of the deck tend to be the most explosive, and as such, also tend to be the weakest as you head into the late game, because you have this density of dead cards, and you have this push and pull almost between your need for lands, creatures, and non-creature spells, which is something that a mono-red deck without the Leyline package doesn't suffer from nearly as badly. However, we did see Gruul Leyline in the top 8 this Pro Tour, and I think part of its presence there is the fact that it was this more aggressive, extremely explosive version, which gives it more game against the prevalence of the control decks and the overlord decks that so dominantly appeared in this meta.
It gets to a point where simply taking 10 damage in one turn is not viable. Like, you can't compete against that. That puts you in a dangerous position. It puts you in a spot where you have to deal with that threat immediately if you are one of those control decks or one of those more mid-range decks, because 2 10 power hits, if you've got nothing, is game.
For a great example of this, I would watch the top 8 match with Gruul Leyline against Domain Overlords. There was obviously some mulligan issues, which was very unfortunate. But one of the things that being aggressive does is it forces your opponent into making deeply unfavorable trades. If you are attacking for 10 on turn 2, your opponent has to cast Rides End there. They can't wait to cast their Beans, or they have to use their Elspeth Smite in a way that is not generating the most value. They can't wait for you not to be holding up their Snakeskin Veil. They just have to act and hope you don't have it. And that is a really powerful element of these hyper-aggressive decks. A really good example is something like Grim Bauble. Sometimes you just have to play the Grim Bauble regardless of whether or not you have the synergy pieces in hand, because if you don't, you're just dead.
Interestingly, Oculus is back.
It is.
We were very much talking about the supposed rumored death of Oculus and how everyone had solved Azorius Oculus because of pieces like Rest in Peace and Ghost Vacuum. But it turns out that the missing piece to Azorius Oculus was red.
This deck is so cool. Channel Fireball really does come up with the best decks and the most exciting decks so much of the time, especially at a Pro Tour level. But this deck really is the piece de resistance. The existence of, or the addition of Inti into the deck and fear of missing out is so, so scary. And it allows for the interactions of discarding Azorius Oculus from your hand in a way that you could only do with Charter Course previously. Also, the discard synergies with Inti and fear of missing out and the delirium synergies are so powerful, especially when your abhorrent Oculus is already feeding your delirium. It allows you to be incredibly aggressive and incredibly proactive, but still not fold to a Leyline of the Void or a Rest in Peace. And that is really what the issue was with Azorius Oculus. It was its weakness to sideboard hate. Now, that's not to say Jeskai Oculus doesn't have weaknesses of its own. It is still a tempo deck. It still struggles to play into the late game against decks like Xur Overlords, but it is so much more resilient and so much more powerful from a mid-range sense. Just the existence of Inti is amazing. And I don't know about you, but I love a 2-mana aggravated assault. Who decided fear of missing out was okay?
I have been very excited with the increased presence of fear of missing out and with people intentionally taking advantage of the delirium effect to force an extra combat. Huge fan. And for a deck like Oculus, it's going to rely on those extra little pushes to get it across the finish line.
The other card that I think really brought Oculus back was Spell Pierce. It's a new toy. It's so good. And it's at its best in this style of resilient tempo deck. Spell Pierce is good when you can obviously use it to counter a removal spell or a board wipe. And it is designed to force through in the short term pieces of interaction. And that is so much more doable when you're an aggressively slanted tempo deck. Have you played much tempo?
I don't think I have. I would not consider myself a very tempo slanted person.
I would give it a go because there is nothing better than a clean tempo game. You feel like you cannot possibly lose. And that's part of the appeal. Playing Delver in Modern is, or was, I suppose, quite similar, where you would play your turn one threat and you'd protect it with spell pierces and you'd kill your opponent with Lightning Bolt and Snapcaster Mage. And this is the new version. And to be perfectly frank with you, it feels a lot more powerful because the actual cards you're using on rate are much better, so you have more capacity to compete with the mid-range decks, which historically were a problem for tempo.
Good deck.
Good deck, turns
Oculus.
Out.
Look, Oculus, it is true as well that it needed those slightly more aggressive pieces because Azorius Oculus was somewhat passive. It relied on the presence of Oculus on the battlefield to continue generating those Manifest Dread cards, and that was kind of it. It had a bit of a control strategy in having a handful of counter spells and a handful of pieces like Elspeth Smite, but it felt like a very passive deck. It felt like, here's my flying 5/5, do something about it. And unfortunately, the threat of do something about it was very easy to counter, just, okay, destroy. Well, you know, there was all kinds of answers to it, and it felt like the deck frequently just sat there. Whereas adding in the red pieces, adding in Inti and adding in Fear of Missing Out, and also giving you access to things like Torch the Tower, incredibly aggressive push, and gave the deck the kick that it needed.
It turns out that dies to removal is still a thing. And tempo fundamentally is almost the quintessential questions deck. It is, hi, I am asking you a question. Can you answer it? I am asking you a question. Can you answer it? But can you answer it through this piece of permission? It's very, very powerful, but when the metagame is set up in such a way that it can be reliably answered, it is, of course, problematic. But with the movement away from Hortigen and into these red powerhouses, I think this deck is here to stay. I think even with the prevalence of very powerful sideboard hate cards like Rest in Peace, this deck is going to continue to pose a problem until the day it rotates out of standard. And frankly, I'm okay with that. Now, you were very, very excited about this next deck.
I've been sitting here waiting to talk about this deck.
Talk to me about Green-Black Graveyard.
Oh my gosh. Okay, if you know anything about me, you know that I am a green player at heart, but if there's anything that I do enjoy, it is Golgari. Black-Green Graveyard was a standout fringe player. Absolute, like, to the T definition of did not see this coming. And this was a deck piloted by Zevin Faust. This deck got a top 8 finish. This was Faust's first pro tour. So his first top 8 finish. Amazing performance. It was very well positioned against aggro. It was very resilient. It had really great pieces from Souls of the Lost, and it generated a lot of value through Up the Beanstalk. It is a beans deck at its core. It goes big, and it develops itself quick enough to get under control decks where necessary. This was my favorite deck of the event. Not only did it lean on the surprise element by taking a different approach to Green-Black Graveyard, but as Zevin Faust said in an interview, he made the top 8 with a bunch of commons and uncommons. The standouts being Huskburster Swarm and Hollow Marauder, which both have cost reductions based on the number of creature cards in your graveyard. And these two cards then triggered Up the Beanstalk to draw cards, and Overwhelming Remorse, also a common, being the most efficient removal spell for the archetype. That was not only a removal spell, but an exile removal spell, which, as we've discussed before, exile removal is peak. If you can exile a threat, you have handled it permanently. I love this deck. I loved seeing this deck at Pro Tour. I was blown away that it made it to top 8. I'm stunned. I'm thrilled. I wish he won the tournament, but alas.
Well, look, Matt Nass, well-deserved victory.
Very well-deserved.
Stalwart of the Magic community, has been playing for God knows how long, and an incredibly good player, especially at these, like, nuanced matchups like a 2.5-hour Domains Overlord's Mirror. So let's not...
Nice.
Yeah, in a row. Whoa. So let's not Discount the achievement of Matt Ness, but oh god, I would love to see this deck increase in prevalence across the metagame because it's so cool and it's so cheap. I reckon you could pick up this deck, mana base aside, for like $100
if you got rid of the Overlords of the Balemirk.
Oh sure,
there are unfortunately 4 copies in the deck. But there is a version of this deck that I will link that is a version that Ash Lizzle put together prior to this event. And I loved the deck that she put together. I started building it in paper. And to see Zevin Faust's version, which is what I would consider a refined version of the Graveyard Beans deck, I'll link that below because her version is far more budget friendly. It only runs 2 Underground Mortuaries instead of 4 that Faust's list runs. It has, I think, again, 2 copies of Overlord of the Balemirk instead of 4. It runs a couple Harvester of Miseries, and it has a few other of the cost reduction creatures that are commons and uncommons. But overall, this is a very budget-friendly deck, mana base and Overlords aside.
And it's a very, I think maybe more importantly, it's a very wild card-friendly deck.
If you're building this deck on Arena, incredibly wild card-friendly. And again, you can make some adjustments to the deck in terms of the mythics being used and the rares to make it even more budget friendly. We'll link all of the top 8 deck lists and the Ash Lizzle list as well. Like anything that we mention here, we'll pop in the description below so you have access to them. Very nice to build on Arena. And again, being a deck that's made of commons and uncommons, somewhat easy to put together as well and budget friendly in that regard. You can, copies of Huskburster Swarm, I think, are 40 cents here in Australia. Big thumbs up.
Big thumbs up indeed. All right, my turn.
Tell me about your favorite deck.
I want to talk about Orzhov Pixie. It was the best overall performing deck at the tournament, which is incredibly biased because it only had one player.
And what was that? What was that percentage win rate for that one player?
I believe it was 88.9%.
My goodness.
Just a casual almost 90% win rate. You know, I wouldn't mind. I'll take that, you know.
What was the highest after that?
The highest after that was Tima Otters.
Oh, at a sweet 80%.
Yeah, so a full 9% over Otters. Yes, please. This version of Pixie leans more into a later game strategy. Pixie is pretty much the only bounce effect in the deck, but it's designed to allow for an infinite value generation using temporary lockdown. It uses Liliana and Hopeless Nightmare to attack the hand, and it also has main deck Lauren to capitalize on the presence of Overlords. It's a great choice for the event, and it's also very cool, and it's what I'm going to be jamming in the future. I love a discard deck. I played quite a bit of Mono Black Waste Knot in Pioneer when it was a thing, and I actually think this kind of deck is also a good teaching tool if you have the cards for newer players, because it teaches them to interact on a card-for-card basis using relatively straightforward principles of card advantage with things like the temporary lockdown and the Lilianas. This deck is incredibly cool. I don't really know what more to say about it aside from go watch the videos of this deck, because it was incredibly high-performing. The player was, of course, very, very skilled, but it's just fun. You can feel the grind, you know?
This deck as well also making the decision to not include blue, which is a key component of the bounce archetype as it stands currently for creating that loop of bounce, pick up Storm Chaser's talent, level up, get back this town, bounce, repeat until...
And don't forget Fear of Isolation as well. Just that another redundant copy of that bounce effect. As we were talking about before, we also did see a resurgence of Azorius Control. And because the Wandering Emperor has rotated out of standard, we haven't really seen it in a while. But with the new Better Divination, which is, of course, Stock Up, which I think is more like a Dig Through Time light, it added a lot of power and card advantage to the deck, which made it an incredibly good call against the current meta where Overlords was so prevalent. While the answers did have to be diversified away from Planeswalkers, Jace the Perfected Mind was still a very good win condition in the late game and provided some card advantage with its tick down. And Overlord of the Mistmoors, of course, proved a very effective finisher against the more mid-range strategies and against aggro. So, what should we expect from the meta? First order reasoning says that we'll see heaps of Xur Overlords. And frankly, of course, we will see heaps of Xur Overlords. It's one of the best decks in the format. It's resilient. It's got some new pieces. It's also the Pro Tour winning deck, which means that we're going to see a spike of it post-Pro Tour. Also, drawing three cards, casting a removal spell, and then attacking with your 4-mana 7-7 that makes 2-2 ones is very exciting. I don't think anybody would blame you for playing Zur Overlords. I think you will do very well with Zur Overlords. If you want to play Zur Overlords, play Zur Overlords.
We'll say this is probably one of the more expensive decks in the standard meta currently, not only due to the mana base, but the presence of the Overlords as well. These are just a bunch of expensive cards.
And unfortunately, a bunch of rares and mythics for your wild cards. So unless you have quite a bit of stuff lying around, it's probably not one to pick up just for the rest of the competitive standard season.
We'll also say this is a deck with what I would consider a high skill level ceiling.
And a high skill floor.
There are some ladders and steps to climb up to. This is a complex deck with complicated play patterns.
And it requires you more than most assertive decks to know and understand the metagame and the cards that you're going to be facing and to build your deck accordingly.
It is also a deck that requires more thinking than your mono red deck.
Certainly, and just more time per game. This deck is probably not what you're going to climb the ladder with out of silver, just because each game is going to take 20 minutes more than if you were playing mono red aggro.
Matt Nass played two-hour back-to-back games of Domain Mirror. These are slow, thoughtful, precision-focused decks that are designed to win on thin margins. Matt Nass stole the win by dealing 54 damage in a single turn.
I'm not sure you can call dealing 54 damage in a single turn stealing a win.
Look, no, I mean, stealing in the sense of cast, if I'm remembering correctly, three Leyline Bindings in a turn.
Runner.
To obliterate his opponent's board, to open up the door, to use the Zur animate effect to animate all of the ley lines to deal that damage. Matt Nass counted out the damage 6 or 7 times.
As you would.
One of the hosts accurately described to Matt Nass, you just solved a $50,000 math puzzle. And that is, it's completely true. And it speaks to the level of complexity of the deck is really what we're getting at here. It is not as simple as turn sideways, swing, win. It is a very thought heavy, insight focused, playing not just for this turn, but for the end of the game.
That being said, it is also a very fun deck.
It's still fun. All right. No. All of the tricky talk aside, Overlords is fine.
It's really fun. Just paying 4 mana and then attacking with a 7-7 lifelink is so nice.
It has fun play patterns. You get to impend Overlord of the Haunted Woods on turn 4, make an everywhere land token. You get to cast Leyline Bindings, typically only for 2 mana. Excellent. It's a fun deck with fun cards. And Matt Nass's build in particular, he gave an incredible interview and wrote a wonderful article on his play throughout the tournament and the way that he and the team designed the deck. And he said that they made the decision to build the deck with the intent of winning the mirror. Like, the point was not, this deck needs to beat Pixie, this deck needs to beat aggro. They know it can do that already. The hardest match for this deck is the mirror. It is sitting out and grinding out the value against your opponent who's also playing Zur Overlords. When you both have beanstalks and you're both triggering them and you're both drawing extra cards, you're both going up in card advantage. Card draw is how you win. And the decision to specifically build the deck to beat Domain, brilliant. And ultimately part of what won him the Pro Tour.
Second order reasoning.
Moving. There's so much more.
moving swiftly on. Second order reasoning says aggro. I think you should expect a lot more of the linear aggro decks. Not the decks that are a little bit more in the mid-rangey camp, but closer to the leyline aggro or the mono red, no aggro, best of one arena kind of linear aggressive decks, as they are ultimately the best way to beat Zur Overlords. I would expect to see it out in droves.
Look, ultimately, if you can fling your Heartfire hero on turn 3 for a 1-turn kill against Overlords, not much they can do because by turn 3 they've typically just impended Overlord of the Haunted Woods. And that's it.
Turn 2 Ride's End, turn 3, Overlord, turn 4. So the quickest Xur Overlords can attack with the lifelinking Overlord is turn 4. If somebody does nothing for 4 turns and you're playing Leyline Aggro, your opponent better be dead or you're doing something wrong.
Yeah. Look, Leyline Aggro at its best, I think, can win on turn 3. Turn 4 is
turn two.
Usually...
Cacophony Scamp. Ah! Turn 2.
Forgot it. Oh, no. Look, regardless, the fact that there are decks that can win on turns 2, 3, 4 means that It can put Overlords in its place.
If you're looking to rank up on Arena quickly, I would be playing Mono Red in Best of 1, and I'd be playing Green Red in Best of 3. Both for clock equity, which of course is just the amount of time per game, and to prey upon the new prevalence of the Pro Tour winning deck, Xur Overlords.
Turn sideways, beat face.
Mm-hmm. You just kind of need to move fast. Overlords is one of the best late game decks by a mile, or a kilometer for those using the metric system, and it's very hard to beat in terms of late game value due to beans, even for the Azorius control decks. But there are some red and red-green aggro decks that can smash out a win in as little as 4 turns, by which point the Overlords player has maybe removed one thing, played a beans, and impended an Overlord. Moving fast is the Overlord killer.
If you can move quickly, efficiently, with purpose, and again, set up your opponent to make some potentially unfavorable plays by not playing beans and instead having to use a get loss to make sure they remove your threat before you can fling it at them. There's still a chance if they have to remove a Cacophony Scamp or a Heartfire here, they're still taking damage for it.
Get loss feels so bad against Mono Red Aggro because you give them 2 ways to trigger Valiant as well. Ugh, it's just so rough. So, Kira, what are you going to be playing?
The answer should be so obvious. I'm going to be playing Zevin Faust's Golgari Graveyard Beans deck. But there is a new contender that I have found that I want to just play for fun a little bit. And it's a Dimir Repurposing Pod artifact deck.
This is a list you'll have to send me.
It's caught my attention. It is a Birthing Pod for Artifacts deck using Simulacrum Synthesizer, Repurposing Bay, and a couple of nasty one-ofs to continuously upcycle your artifacts into bigger and bigger threats.
What are you podding your Memory Guardian into?
You can pod your Memory Guardian because it's a 5 cost. There is a 1 of Chimil of the Inner Sun.
Ooh.
And a 1 of Nexus of Becoming. And you can... Here's what... This is a spoiler. I'm going to give you guys a little spoiler. You can pod your Memory Guardian into a Nexus of Becoming, exiling 3-fold Thunder Hulk, and getting 6 1-1 gnomes when it enters.
All right, that sounds like a blast.
I will link to that list below. That list was just played by Seth Saffron Olive from MTG Goldfish for Against the Odds. It was a very cool artifact pod deck that immediately I had to start picking up the pieces for, and we'll link that in the description as well.
I, as I've said already, am going to be playing Azorius. Azorius?
No.
Orzhov Pixie.
Orzhov Pixie.
The deck's just looks too sweet. I gotta play it. I gotta get my reps in. I gotta lose terribly, terribly to all these mono red aggro decks. And that's okay.
Look, some of the most important parts of the games that you'll play in Standard are the ones you lose.
For sure. That's how we learn. That's how we learn. So, with all that said, that is all that we have for you today. We look forward to seeing you again next week. New episodes release on Mondays at 11 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. Until then, you can keep track of all of our releases at RaiseMTG on both Instagram and Bluesky. You can find Kira on the same platforms at kirabobira.jpg on Instagram and kirabobira on Bluesky, and myself at MayaMTG. A big thank you to the State Library of Victoria for the ongoing use of their space. And until next week, remember, it's not so bad. All you have to do is keep from looking down.